From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Steve Taravella is my guest. His new book is a biography of an actress that you have seen time and again in the movies and on television, but whose name, perhaps, you have never known. The book is called Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. Steve Taravella, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much for this, Gary, and I'm glad to hear the enthusiasm in your voice when you talk about Mary.
I'm a big fan. Let's begin with her credits. What are the film and television roles for which Mary Wicks is best known?
I suppose in film she's best known for things like playing the housekeeper opposite Bing Crosby in White Christmas, or the nurse with Betty Davis in Now Voyager, or for younger audiences, in the Sister Act movies with Whoopi Goldberg. She was the crotchety choir director who feared Whoopi was taking her job from her. And in television, probably Dennis the Menace is one of the shows that she was a regular on that people, for various reasons, just love all these years later.
They're all on DVD and all that.
Exactly.
I think my first memory of her, I used to watch the Mickey Mouse Club every day, and there was a serial featuring Annette, and Annette played a little girl who had come from Beaver Falls to live with her aunt and uncle, played by Richard Deacon and some other lady, I can't remember.
Exactly,
And Katie was the maid, and that was Mary Wicks.
And you remember her from that?
Yeah, I do.
Wow.
I remember her because she was the narrator as well as being the housekeeper on the show.
In fact, she had the opening line in the first episode of the series,
yeah,
which was something kind of special for her.
Did she do a lot of Disney work?
No, not really. She did that, the Annette serial, and she had small parts in a couple of Disney films years later, like Napoleon and Samantha. But maybe her biggest connection with the Disney Empire is that she was the original Mary Poppins. She played Mary Poppins in a live television show in 1949 and had a lot of fun with it, really, really respected that role and the part and took great pride in having been the first, and was actually a little resentful years later when she wasn't considered seriously for the part in the movie that we all know Julie Andrews as now.
Right. Right. Well, you know, so here she is, a star of television. Not a star, but an actress on stage, on television, and in the movies, but never a star. Was she ever a top-billed actress in a movie or a television show?
Boy, good question. No, I don't think she ever was. There were times when she was prominently billed, and in her contract negotiations, she often sought and was granted and also starring tag at the end of the opening credits, which appeared in larger type and maybe remained on screen for a moment longer. Mm. And that was one way of recognizing the really long career she'd had. But no, she never was a star, and that's what enabled her to build such a long career. You know, she really was a supporting player, and that was her bread and butter income.
And she was also not a particularly attractive woman, and that, I guess in some ways that is an advantage too. That is, if you're a great beauty and then your beauty fades, well, then I guess you're done. But if you didn't have great beauty to begin with, you could have a longer career.
Absolutely. And she had a really healthy outlook on that, I think. She was decidedly unattractive by any measure, although less so when she was younger. I've seen some photos of her as a young woman that struck me. There were many attractive features she had when she was younger. But it's true that had she been a more conventionally attractive woman, she wouldn't have been offered the many kinds of roles that she was later. That enabled her to sustain a career better.
I remember her in an Abbott and Costello picture. I think it's Who Done It.
Ah.
And Costello is being urged by Abbott to make love to Mary, and he says, she don't appeal to me.
Yeah, yeah. There were a lot of films that really relied on very disparaging dialogue about her. I mean, I was surprised that she would take parts that where other characters spoke so mockingly of her appearance. But, you know, part of it, I think, was the times. I don't think performers today would speak disparagingly of women on film the way they did in those times. But also, it's a case of her knowing where she was going to get the work, you know?
Well, now, Steve Taravella, you're a film historian, but how did you get interested in writing about Mary Wicks?
I'd always wanted to write a biography, though I certainly didn't set out to write Mary's story. But when in my personal life I found myself moving from Northern California to Washington, D.C., without a job, following a partner, I decided this was the opportunity to take some time out of the workforce and write that book. So I started with Mary to see if by chance her life was interesting enough to justify a book, because it might not have been. And I quickly decided it was. I mean, the animator's model for Cruella de Vil, the original Mary Poppins, a part of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater Company, Lucille Ball's closest friend for some 30 years. I think she had an interesting life that went largely untold.
You know, I wonder about her financial life. I mean, since she was never a big star, but she worked steadily, was she a rich woman or just a middle-class woman?
Good question. No, I wouldn't call her rich. She was comfortable largely because she worked nonstop. There was never an opportunity to take a paying job that Mary turned down. We have to remember that in many of the years Mary worked, actors weren't paid the big sums that they're paid now, and they weren't paid residuals like they're paid now.
Mm.
So when Mary passed away, she left an estate valued at just over $2 million, which surprised me. I expected to find Mary had left an estate quite larger than that. And yet when I mentioned that figure to some of her contemporaries, also in the business, they were surprised that it was so much.
Hmm.
So I think it's all perspective, but she was a very thrifty woman who feared investments and treated her money very conservatively. She never invested in the stock market. So to have worked for those years without a lot of residuals, with very modest incomes, without investment, and end her life with $2 million, I think she did very well for herself.
Oh, yeah. I would like $2 million, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
but on the other hand, her friend, her best friend, as you mentioned, was Lucille Ball. And Lucille Ball, I mean, I don't know how much money Lucy had, but it had to be a lot.
Exactly. But we have to remember Lucille Ball wasn't just an actress. Lucille Ball was a businesswoman like no other of that time period.
Right.
She ran a studio. She had ownership interest in a studio and production companies and merchandise. And, you know, even today, the Lucille Ball merchandise is a business.
Right, yeah.
And Mary never really had that opportunity. I don't think we'd see Mary Wicks action figures, you know?
Yeah, why not? Though I want one. Well, let's talk a little bit about her career. She started on Broadway, or she started on the stage?
She did. She started on the stage, like a lot of women that generation who were interested in acting, in community theater. St. Louis had a vibrant community theater in the 1930s that was called the Little Theater, part of a network around the country. And it gave her a great opportunity to see if this was something for her. At first, I don't think she entered Little Theater with any intention of building a career. It was a way for her to have a social life and remain engaged with the community and have something to do in the evenings. And then found out she was actually quite good at it. Audiences from very early in her career responded very well to Mary on stage. And I think those laughs were contagious, and she, you know, decided by the mid-30s this is what she wanted to do, and began professionally at the Stockbridge, Massachusetts, with the Berkshire Theater Company, and from there to Broadway and New York.
What were some of her early Broadway parts?
Probably her biggest part early on was something called Stage Door, which many people now remember as a film. I think a film that holds up quite well, about a group of single, young, aspiring actresses sharing a boarding house in Manhattan. And Mary was just part of the ensemble. But it was a comedy, and she was very effective, and That show ran for quite a long time and caught the eye of other people who hired her for other things. That was also the first of five plays in which Mary originated a role for George S. Kaufman, the playwright and director, with whom she had a lifelong close friendship after that.
I guess the most famous of those would have to be The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Exactly.
She
and that was a role that she loved. She played the, as you know, the wisecracking, caustic, put-upon nurse. And in a play where tension is built up from the beginning toward a really unpleasant, insufferable character, Mary gets the pleasure of being the character to tell him off in a grand moment, and the audience is all with her at that moment, and Mary got sustained applause every time she did it. And she played that part in many different settings. She played it later in a television production, radio. And
I mean, she played it when she was young, and she played it when she was not as young.
Exactly. Yeah. And how many actresses could play the same part when they were, 29, and then again when they're 75, something like that.
Isn't that crazy? And,
yeah.
And she, I remember her getting a huge, I mean, she's really got the first act finale laugh. It's like a big, the curtain in the first act is all her.
Exactly.
So that was an important role for her.
It was. It was almost a defining role for good and bad. Good because people remembered her from that and then considered her for other things because of it. Bad because it really did pigeonhole her, for lack of a better expression, as the nurse.
I mean, Mary. The nurse, the maid, the whatever, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think I call one of the chapters Nurses, Nuns, and Housekeepers. You know, Mary played most of her career wearing black or white, and either the housekeeper's apron or the nun's habit. But she played an awful lot of nurses, which some other actresses might have rolled their eyes at. Mary was always so grateful for work. She took the profession so seriously. She was happy to have the job, and she genuinely loved nursing. In her private life, she was a hospital volunteer for decades.
Hmm. We're talking with Steve Taravella, and his book is called Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. Did Kaufman create the role of the nurse with her in mind?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. If he didn't create it for her, he certainly made it hers in the course of rehearsals and the production. There were other parts he created with her in mind. He said later that he never wrote a play without a character called Mary Wicks in the writing stages, sort of a placeholder for Mary in hopes that she could play it, and she did in the end play five. On second thought, I think you're right. I think she did originally. I think he did create that for her, and he promised her that if the play were ever to be made into a film, he would see to it that she was cast as the nurse. Now, at that point, Mary had never appeared in film. So that may have sounded like something of a hollow promise, but in reality, it was made into a film, a very successful film, with a top-line cast, and Mary was the first performer cast in it because George S. Kaufman negotiated, he kept his promise, and when he negotiated with Warners, that's one thing he asked for, that Mary Wicks play the nurse.
Hmm. And Bette Davis is in the picture. And
exactly.
It's a great movie. I love it. And she's great in it. Mary Wicks is great in it.
Yeah, I think she had a lot of fun with it, too. And it was one of three films that she did with Bette Davis. And they were close in that time period. In the course of this book, I encountered correspondence that hadn't been published before between Bette Davis and Mary Wicks that I excerpt in the book that, you know, really makes clear Bette Davis looked at Mary as somebody she could trust and confide in. This was during a time when she had terrible marital troubles and her husband left her for her child's nursemaid, and Bette Davis was confiding about her divorce and getting used to a new husband. And, you know, Mary was the kind of person who didn't exploit friendships with better known people. She kind of knew her place in the Hollywood pecking order. And certainly because of her looks, she wasn't threatening to more glamorous actresses. So a fair number of actresses of Bette Davis's stature felt perfectly safe confiding in her.
That's an interesting thing. Now, Orson Welles, she was part of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater?
Right, she was. And that's another example of the benefit that came to Mary from stage door. Orson Welles, as a theater-goer, saw Mary on stage and liked her in that, remembered her in that. And when he was casting the following year something called Shoemaker's Holiday for the Mercury Theater Company, Orson Welles, this sort of renegade avant-garde director of the day, asked Mary to be part of the cast, and she couldn't because she was committed to another stage production. But shortly after that, he was casting another production, turned to Mary again, she was available, and she joined the company. And that was what became the ill-fated production that maybe your listeners have seen headlines about recently, Too Much Johnson,
the right, because film that... The film, exactly. The film elements have surfaced, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They were found in a warehouse in Italy, never having been seen. And those elements will be shown in about 3 weeks in Rochester.
Wow.
For the first time.
And is Mary in them or not? She's not part of the film.
No, she is.
Oh, uh-huh.
She is. Mary was, there were actors who were in only the film component of this production, others only the stage component, and still others who were in both. And Mary was one who was in both.
So this is Orson Welles, what people who are listening should know. This is Orson Welles' first film before Citizen Kane.
Exactly.
Yeah. But with Joseph Cotten.
With Joseph Cotten, who was an unknown at the time, as were many of the people in that company.
Was she a part of Welles' Mercury Theater of the Air as well?
Yes. And she did 4 or 5 radio shows, all of which were after that production. She did 17. She did several others with Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles. She wasn't close to either of them, and didn't see much of either of them after that. But I think that her experience with the Mercury was still kind of a defining experience, in that it really everything else about Mary had been so conventional and traditional up until that point in her life, that this marked something that was a little more avant-garde, risky for her.
She also was an actress who worked in pretty much every genre. I don't think there's a kind of movie that she was not in. I mean, she was in musicals, she was in thrillers, she was in dramas, she was in every kind of picture.
It's true, isn't it?
Westerns, she was in quite a few of everything. She was in everything.
Is there a role of hers that you especially like?
Well, I guess The Man Who Came to Dinner is really great. I love that. And I loved her on the, it wasn't The Lucy Show, it was Here's Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Well, she was in many of both, so it could have been. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember her, I think, on Here's Lucy, where she had a recurring part.
Right. Right.
Well, I mean, I just love her, and whenever I see her, I think, oh, there's Mary Wiggs. And people say, who the hell is Mary Wiggs?
I
was just thinking about this. Not only was she in White Christmas, which is one of the fine films of Bing Crosby's, but she was also in Frank Sinatra's first movie.
She was. Something called Higher and Higher,
yeah.
Which I hadn't seen until I started researching the book. Had you seen that before?
Well, yes, I have, because I love Sinatra, and he sings I Couldn't Sleep a Wink Last Night, and he sings a couple of other great songs in there, and Dooley Wilson from Casablanca's in that movie also, and Jack Haley.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I like that movie a lot.
Well, from the perspective of Mary's career, it's an interesting film, not just because she had a prominent role in Frank Sinatra's first film, but because Mary's role was rather prominent. She wasn't just the secondary sidekick that she found herself in so many productions. She was a big part of the ensemble, but she also sang. And Mary didn't have the best singing voice, but you know, she would try anything she was asked to do. And in fact, she did pretty well in that film. There were maybe 4 or 5 times in her career where she was asked to sing as well as act. And I thought she did a nice job in that film.
I also like her in those 2 movies that are stupid, but that I love. The Trouble with Angels and Where the Angels Go, Trouble Follows.
Isn't it funny how we all feel bad for liking those?
Well, they're stupid, but, you know, they're fun.
No, I think you're right on both counts. They're fun. And they were fun for her. She had a ball doing them. Partly because she had real respect for women in religious life. She loved playing nuns. She was a devout Episcopalian herself and understood the religious experience. But also she really liked Rosalind Russell and had a lot of fun doing those films. She even arranged to have her church in Beverly Hills use one of them as part of its religious instruction program for adolescents.
Well, that might be dubious, but okay, why not? We're talking with Steve Taravella, and his book is called Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. And let's talk a little bit about her personal life. I mean, her primary relationship in her life was with her mother.
You're right. These were two women who were absolutely devoted to each other. When I realized just how close Mary was to her mother, I began to assume that it was a rather begrudging relationship on Mary's part, that she felt obligated as an only child of a surviving parent to devote so much of her life to her mother. But no, in fact, this was done with love and willingly. Mary adored her mother, actually enjoyed her company, wanted to be with her. There wasn't a lot that Mary ever did out of obligation, and certainly not with her mother. They were two peas in a pod in every way.
Mary never married or had any personal relationship with another human being?
No, she never married. She never had children. She never had a romance of any kind with a man or a woman. There were crushes that she had over the years, mostly when she was younger. Most of her friends, when I began asking, I guess I interviewed almost 300 people for this book, and most of her friends, when I began asking about Mary's personal life, offered up, even without my asking, that they were certain that Mary had died a virgin, that she was such a singularly asexual woman in her approach to life and approach to people and whatnot. She really just didn't give off any romantic energy, so to speak, although I hate that expression, but no, she really had no romantic life. And I think had she been born at a different time, she probably would have lived a life of much less sexual repression. Told people who asked, she was happy with the life she had. She had friends who were good company for her.
Well, most of her close friends were women, though.
She had many close friends who were women, but also many friends who were men. A lot of her closest friends were gay men, which is something that Mary wasn't always aware of, especially in the early part of her life, say the 1930s through 60s. I would say most of the men in her life were gay men, but Mary, for a time, considered some of them beaux in that very Victorian genteel way of looking at relationships, B-E-A-U-X.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, that wasn't a possibility. But I suppose in her very last years, yes, it's true that the people who she spent the most time with were women. And she did have close friends. She had friends who weren't just of the theater or the profession, but friends from her church she really enjoyed spending time with. And I think one of her very closest friends near the end of her life, in the last, say, 20 years of her life, was her pastor and his family.
We're talking with Steve Taravella. His book is a biography of actress Mary Wicks, who was really a pioneer in television. She was one of the first in TV.
She was. Her first television production was 1945.
I mean, I didn't even know they had TV in 1945.
Well, that may have been the very first year. I even had to double-check that reference when I came across it to make sure it wasn't 46 or 47. But in 1945, she had a part in what was called an NBC sustainer, something that aired live out of New York on NBC.
300 people were watching it.
Well, there were so few television sets.
Yeah.
You know? But she, for somebody who was reluctant to accept change in a lot of parts in her life, when changes surfaced in her industry and profession, she didn't run from them. So when television came about, Mary saw it not as something to be dismissed as some of her other theater colleagues did. You know, a lot of people in the theater looked down their nose at television for years. Mary saw it as another way to make money. And she took every job she could get in television. She was a guest on Gloria Swanson's live television show on the old Dumont Network, which...
It was a talk show?
It was a talk show. what was called a ladies' talk show.
None of these still... You couldn't find any kinescopes. No, it doesn't exist anymore.
No, isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
No, there's no visual record. I found only one still photo that was taken on the set that day, and I did use that in the book.
Uh-huh.
That was in Gloria Swanson's papers in Austin, Texas. But I guess my point with that is just that I think that's an example of how she didn't run from this new technology, but embraced it and sought ways to use it to her advantage.
Well, she was brave.
She was. Yeah. I mean, you used the word pioneering, and I think for a woman with Mary's looks to embark upon a career as an actress at a time when being an actress meant looking like Carol Lombard, yeah, that took a certain amount of chutzpah and courage to have the self-confidence to think that she could do that, especially when having come from a rather conservative, traditional family that didn't necessarily welcome, you know, unusual behavior.
It really is a remarkable career. I enjoyed the book very much. I mean, she made films with some of the great performers of the 20th century. She appeared on some of the greatest television shows. She worked with some of the great directors. Really an interesting and varied career. And the book is called Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. And the author, my guest, Steve Taravella. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, you're welcome. Thank you. It was fun to have a chance to share these stories.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time. Come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. You can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Steve Taravella. His book is called Mary Wicks. I know I've seen that face before. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.